Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of the Jolly Heretic on Tour. I'm still in this swanky studio in Barnes, and I have a very special guest for you today, and that is Dr. Nima Parvini, otherwise known as the Academic Agent. Nima, hello, how do you do?
Thanks for having me, Ed.
It's good to see you again. We were just discussing that Nima does look a bit like Michael Flanders, the 1950s, 1960s songwriter, the writer of Mud, Mud, Glorious Mud, and other hits, which you young people won't have heard of. But do you're not familiar with Mud, Mud, Glorious Mud?
I'm afraid not.
Mud, Mud, Glorious Mud. Come on, surely.
I need to get a fay with the works of Flanders.
You do well, Flowers and Swan. Didn't they have Mud, Mud, Glorious Mud in rural Wales in the 80s?
No, I can't. No, I don't remember that one.
All right. Okay. Well, never mind. Well, you'll find it later. You'll find it later. But it was obviously I got to know. I think it was you originally that got in touch with me and asked me to come on your channel. This is ages, while ago now, wasn't it? It was. I came on your channel. That's my memory of things. And it was already doing pretty well then. How long have you been running it for?
Since 2016.
Yeah. 2016. So since the year of the great. Before or after the
It was November, so it was the time of I think Trump had just been elected, or he's just about to be elected.
The time of the great strife.
Yes, post Brexit had happened. I think Trump was about to get elected.
So what was it that persuaded you to, why do you think it's managed to become, by YouTube standards, reasonably popular? Why do you think what do you think appeals about it?
Well, I mean, charisma, good looks.
Well, hang on a minute. The good looks is, we don't even see you.
Probably the secret of my channel success is that good research. I've always researched topics inside and out, and a genuine curiosity to discover what's really happening. Mm-hmm. And a willingness to develop and grow. And I think that that's possibly been the thing that's kept people around in my audience for as long as they've been there. And also why, when people start watching, they then continue watching, because I think, you know, they trust me to tell them the truth ultimately.
Uh-huh. And what was it that persuaded you to set it up? Why did you set up the...
Well, if you remember back in those days, there was a lot of stuff going on about feminism, and there was a channel, Sargon of Akkad, which I'm sure you're familiar with, Carl Benjamin. Mm. And he was making a lot of videos about why people hate feminism at the time. And it was quite clear to me that at that time, obviously not the Carl of today, but the Carl of, 7 years ago now, he was not familiar with a lot of the kind of theory, I guess, behind a lot of the left-wing assumptions, Marxist theory, feminist theory. I remember people like Michel Foucault. And I remember he was kind of struggling through it once, and he kept on saying, he was saying something like Michael for Kant or something like that. And so I thought, well, I could make a series of explainers explaining this kind of left-wing ideas in short edited videos to try to help people like Carl along. Mm. And that's what I did originally. Here I am.
But your background was in English literature. You've written about Shakespeare, and that's your main.
Yes, I've written 5 books on Shakespeare, and if you pick up those, you'll see there's quite a lot of stuff on Marxist theory, post-structuralist theory, and things like that, which I had been critiquing. A lot of my work was actually questioning some of these assumptions. I was, intellectually curious, and that's basically how I found my way onto YouTube, to try to explain and critique those things. And then as time has gone on, I came to realize, actually, in a strange way, that some of the fundamental assumptions that I was railing against back then, in the left-wing theorists, people like Althusser, Antonio Gramsci, and so on, actually have a grain of truth to them. A lot of that stuff is about
how... You mean the theories themselves have a grain of truth?
The theories of themselves have a grain of truth to them. And then at some point I'd realise, actually, they'd won. I.e. the fight that I was trying to have within the academy had already been lost because the...
Or because they're right.
Not because they're right in their left-wing assumptions, but because they had worked out a way of subverting an entire culture, subverting an entire ideological system. A lot of the stuff I've done basically has really been using a lot of the tools that they use to deconstruct the West as it was in the 1950s, for example, essentially to turn it back around and deconstruct the world that they have created in its place.
But that's what Karl Marx that said, that people say that he said that the purpose of academia is to change the world as opposed to describe the world, and that's what they've done, and they've done so. Gramsci is an obvious example. They've done so magnificently to just describe, this is what you have to do. You have to forget the traditional thing that you've been told about storming the Winter Palace or whatever. That's nonsense. You have to, but before you do that, you have to lay the ground. How do you lay the ground? You march your way slowly, gradually, Tony Blair-like, slowly, 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 bit by bit, salami tactics, so no one notices. And then you wake up one day and every organ of society is subverted, every organ of society waves the rainbow flag, or whatever it happens to be, and does it passionately, and that's how they got it so right. But you came up with quite interesting. I've quite liked the way that you come up with these quite interesting metaphors or cultural allusions for this, like the idea of the Boomer Truth Regime or the Daria. There was that series you did about the Daria. Can you explain a bit about that for those that haven't seen? I particularly liked that.
I mean, just to explain very quickly, the Boomer Truth Regime basically is the kind of cultural paradigm or episteme that we've been in since the Second World War, since 1945, wherein the ultimate good is something like individual freedom of expression, something like this, or individual freedom unbound by any societal constraints, okay, in a Rousseauian sense. And then the ultimate evil is basically Hitler. I mean, literally anything, and when you start to get in, so a lot of what I've done is then try to work out how this truth regime came about and what are some of its kind of ultimate weapons. And the Daria video that I made was really about...
Would you mind awfully explaining to the assembled, many of them are quite young, who Daria is?
So Daria was a cartoon show, I think, in the early 90s, late 80s sort of time, maybe in the mid-90s. She was a very kind of cynical character. She was very, she was not very emotional. Nothing kind of bothered her. And she was, I guess, what you call a deadpan snarker. But I would argue that Daria was only the last in a long line of deadpan snarkers, who include Blackadder, Bill Murray in general, Bart Simpson, various. I mean, basically all the characters you can think of when we grew up, Ed, were some sort of smartass. And in fact, I think that...
Cynical of the current thing, and the current things being the fag end of the traditional society.
Yeah, they're cynical. They are, they're prone to mock ideas like religion.
Stuart Lee's.
Yeah, much like, again, Stuart Lee would be on the tail end of it, but essentially that basic character. And it struck me, actually, that this Gen X Daria character is one of the... defense mechanisms of what we call the regime, or the Boomer Truth Regime, because that stops them ever straying too far away from the reservation, ironically, because the things they're cynical about are actually things that you're encouraged or allowed to be cynical about, one of which would be traditional religions, authority, but authority as depicted in Monty Python, the old order, as opposed to
upper class, sort of the year.
Yeah, as opposed to the new order, which actually isn't questioned. So the exact same cynical Gen X Darius, for example, who would treat those things with cynicism and be kind of sarcastic about them, wouldn't dare question, for example, I don't know, taking the vaccines during COVID. They actually were some of the most obedient people during that period. I just find the mechanism interesting because all of those people believe that they're being cynical and that they're free thinkers, but in fact, they are conforming exactly to what the social order requires of them, almost as a kind of antibody against any outside thought. Particularly prevalent in our generation, I would say.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I presumably in our, I mean, you're a couple of years younger than me, mm-hmm. early 80s. Mm-hmm. It was the sort of end of it. It was the gradual end of it. When I started school, I still had some teachers that were born, my headmistress, infant school, for example, are born in the late 1920s. You mm-hmm. still had people that were senior police officers that were, Mrs. Thatcher was born in 1925. Mm-hmm. So you've got these people born in the 20s, before the war, before everything sort of changed, and they have those values, and they've been in a war, and they're traditionalist, and they have these ideas that now you consider appalling. I mean, Margaret Thatcher said, with regard to any discussion of homosexuality in schools, those children are being cheated out of a sound start in life. And yes, cheated, mm-hmm. and passed laws to stop them promoting homosexuality in schools. And now this is the most terrible, terrible thing. Mm-hmm. The change since Blair, obviously, yeah. is enormous. But the rebellion then, the rebellion as a kid then. And it's not really a rebellion, but it's sort of, because you've still got this old, what are now people that are 100 years old in mm. charge or dead, is, oh yeah, I'm an atheist. Oh yeah, yeah. I'm left wing. Oh yeah, it's okay to be gay. Oh, how dare you be racist? Mm. All this, that's the rebellion. But gradually it becomes a non-rebellion. It becomes a faux rebellion. It becomes actually useful.
Status quo. And this is one of the things really that I started to see when I was in academia. Everything I wrote was against the kind of stultifying orthodoxy that had grown up within the discipline I was working in. But you can actually see it at a wider cultural level. And I think the left still struggles very much with the idea that they are in power, that they have achieved basically all of their ends. They still want to operate on the assumption that they are the ones who are countercultural. They are the ones who are kicking against the system, whereas in fact, of course, they have the same politics now as a HR poster. One of the another slogans I've used before is, if you're kicking against an open door, you are not a radical. And of course, everything they want is everything that the system wants as well. So in a strange way, the kind of someone who would have been considered subversive in the 1960s or 70s, you know, an atheist, a kind of countercultural boomer or whatever, is now actually the orthodoxy in a way that I find
literally, if we're knighting the Rolling Stones.
Exactly.
Who were countercultural, people forget this, but in the early 60s, they were. It was considered sort of shocking. And these people are literally knights of the realm. Then this is demonstrating to you the nature of the change. That even something like stand-up comedy we've talked about before, alternative comedy in the 80s, Rick Mayall or whatever, when he was doing, this was something radical. Mm-hmm. This was subversive. Now, all comedy is that. Is Nish Kumar, yeah. people like this.
I kind of think that this has led to a kind of stultification on the left in general, whereby they are kind of frozen in the cultural moment of 1968 or in the mid-70s, i.e. they very much struggle to move on from the basic set of analyses they made of the 1950s. And, back when I was teaching students, I actually was the one who would teach them Foucault and Althusser and so on. And I actually did something that, because if you have a look at the way these things are typically taught, they will give them stuff from the 1950s to deconstruct, something which is always, you could say, being deconstructed their entire lives. So, you know, it's very safe and very easy for a student to look at a 1950s housewives manual and say, oh, isn't it awful, isn't that sexist, and so on. But what I did is that I gave them front covers of Vogue magazine from today, you know, which typically would have been already decolonized, already girl-powered, already, you know. It was actually something that was reflecting the ideological values of now, right? And what I wanted to do was to see how many of those students would even be able to ideologically unpack what was happening on the front cover of Vogue in 2019 or whatever the date was. And that was something that I could tell they knew that there was a danger there, because they were actually dealing with the power structures of now. And in a way, that's a microcosm of where the left have been for a long time, because they almost refuse to use their own tools against their own ideological system.
One of the things that I was talking to some students at Oxford University the other day, and some quite otherwise quite intelligent and articulate young women, and actually quite open-minded once I challenged what they were saying, but it obviously hadn't been challenged before, was they were saying, when I talked about, well, how important is it to debate controversial opinions and the boundaries of free speech and all this, and one of the things they both said, these two girls, was that, well, there are certain debates that we've had. We've come to those conclusions. We'll move past that. Of course people have to have rights. Of course we have to respect people's sexuality. And these things, perhaps these things shouldn't be debated at all, because we've had that debate. So we shouldn't waste time continuing to have that debate, because we've had that debate and we've come to our conclusion. So we will move on to something else. And I said, well, hang on, couldn't people in the 1950s, what if they said, well, we've had that debate over young mothers that get pregnant outside of wedlock, and we've had that debate. Of course they're unsuitable to be mothers. Of course they are unsuitable, and we must of course take their children away from them and place them with a respectable middle-class family. We've had that debate. Mm-hmm. What would you say to that? And also I said, and if you say that, there are nuances to debates. Aren't you creating a rather intimidating atmosphere to say to people, well, we've had that debate, this is not to be discussed. You're creating an anti-intellectual atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And they thought about that, and they kind of then started to nuance a bit what they were saying. But it was interesting then that afterwards they came up to me and said, oh, can you not use the footage? Or can you blur my face out? Because they were aware what they were now dealing with was something a little bit dangerous. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think that's what you're...
Well, of course, the truth is that the debate never really took place. In almost every case, the debate never happened. And the left, embodied in a figure like Tony Blair, simply acted as if the debate had already taken place and just simply passed laws, you know, top down, and just simply moved past the point of sale. This has been a trick of the left going back to, you know, Brown versus Board of Education, and in fact, even before that time, they simply act, and then the culture catches up to where they are. So I would even question the premise of the two girls there, that a debate had actually happened. A debate had not happened. People were simply told, well, now it's illegal.
I suppose you could argue that in a lot of academic areas, it's not, the debate doesn't happen at all, ever.
No, never.
There are cultural revolutions in academia and in society in general, and there are shifts, and they happen very quickly, and they happen primarily for emotional reasons, because people notice that the up and coming in thing, whatever, is going to be this. And they migrate very quickly. There's experiments on this, about 20%.
Well, it's extremely faddish. I mean, one of the most depressing things I found in my research on Shakespeare and Shakespeare scholarship in general is that people don't come to these kind of eureka moments through like intellectual thought. They jump on the latest trendy thing. I remember distinctly reading this one book that had been written in 1985, where this guy, I won't name who it is, but he basically says at the start, well, up until this point I've been doing psychoanalytic feminism, but basically the cool thing now is historical materialism, so I'm going to be a new historicist now. You know, the time is right to do this. Didn't really, just was like, oh yeah, it's time to do a different type of work now. and now I'm going to write my new historicist book and, you know,
forget well, stuff I suppose if you've got a discipline within academia that's completely interpretivist, then what the hell is the point of one form of interpretation over the other? What is the point of changing from doing, I don't know, some of my training was in cultural anthropology and social anthropology. That was traditional anthropology, not postmodern. Like Victor Turner, Mary Douglas, these structuralism, as mentioned, it was called structuralism. And a lot of people suddenly realised, oh no, the time is right for post-structuralism, i.e. postmodernism. Why? Because that's what you have to do to get published. And I was actually told when I submitted an article once to a particular academic journal, and he said, the editor wrote back and said, I'm not going to send this out for review. Why not? Well, it's very old-fashioned. You're using the structuralist analysis, Victor Turner, Mary Douglas. It's a bit old-fashioned. But we're more into the kind of, I think, what was the word he used? Cutting edge, was it? What was the word he used for it? Contemporary, that was the word he used, contemporary. Contemporary anthropology, which means postmodern anthropology. And that's what you do. So it's just fashion.
Yeah, I mean, it's simply just kind of decided. Now, that was what used to happen, let's say, you know, 40 years ago. These days, it's much more, obviously, especially in this country, top-down driven by funding bodies. Where a arts council or British council or whatever, they will decide, oh, the themes of this year are sustainability, let's just say, this is the buzzword, and then all of the proposals for that year have to try to tie in sustainability. You get, you know, I mean, I remember reading book proposals for all sorts of atrocious projects like... you know, what can Chaucer teach us about renewable farming methods? You know, reading Chaucer and then trying to... Because and the reason they were doing that is because there's this kind of utilitarian need in the proposal to try to show impact, what they call impact, in the real world.
Mm.
So they have to... Everybody then has to buy into this fiction that, you know, reading Chaucer can kind of... teach you how to...
It's not a good in itself to know about the important literature of our own society.
It now has to tie into some other project, in this case, renewable farming methods.
I mean, he doesn't actually talk that much about that in Chaucer, right? On my holiday reading when I was in Albania this summer, in the southern Albania on holiday, sitting on a sun lounger, was to read all of the prologues to Canterbury Tales. I read all of the prologues. It's very disappointed by the ending to Canterbury Tales, by the way. It's a very disappointing ending. There was no denouement, there was just some praying. It's a very disappointing ending. If I was the publisher of Canterbury Tales, I would have said that, Geoffrey, mate... It's all quite good. It's quite good. But I need to rewrite. The ending's rubbish. I like that bit where those two blokes come along, Sir Topaz and the other one, and they have an argument. And that's good. That's interesting. But I don't like this. This is a bad ending. But no, I don't remember anything about sustainability or whatever in Chaucer at all. Even poetry now. I was in Oxford the other day, and my colleague was doing something else, and so I said, oh, well, I'm going to go to Blackwell's and I'll have a look at the poetry. And I had a look at it. And without exception, it was rubbish. I mean rubbish.
Mm-hmm.
No skill. No, it wasn't even like blank prose level of skill, where in blank prose can be good. You can have interesting metaphors and allusions and stuff like that. It was just sort of stream of consciousness crap. And that's what passes for poetry these days. It doesn't rhyme. There's a politicization even of poetry. You have to go to like conservative journals to have poetry that actually is like actual poetry. Even that's subverted. I don't understand how they managed to do it so successfully, even down to poetry, which now doesn't create a sense of beauty or the transcendent or whatever. It just creates a sense of weird confusion. Why have we done that?
I would say that in most of those cases, it is an effect of elite capture, you know, through, like you were saying, the march through the institution. What that really means is that anybody who was conservative or anyone who had a different idea of what poetry could be, for example, would either be, you know, shuffled off into, you know, after they retired, or they simply wouldn't be hired in the first place, or they'd be fired. And that's basically what they've done since the 70s. So that is something that has happened not just in academic departments, but across the board, including in corporate boards and, very, you know, just across society. Because the left have always believed in the means justifies the ends, right? And they do not think twice about a political appointment. You can actually read moments where there was some kind of rear guard action in Cambridge, for example. There was somebody famously hired in the early 80s who was a left winger, and the department at the time, like, we don't want this sort of stuff here, and there was a big kind of battle over it.
There was a battle over giving Derrida an honorary doctorate.
Yes, I mean, and that was kind of in the mid 90s. So, yeah. The Oxbridge had a little bit longer before they finally succumbed.
And there's a left wing press called Icon Books. Mm-hmm. It's based in Cambridge, and they do these what's called beginner's guides. They're basically cartoon books, mm-hmm. aimed at sort of sixth formers, I suppose, mm-hmm. about. There's a beginner's guide to Nietzsche, there's a beginner's guide to Foucault, there's a beginner, whatever, any sort of important idea or person. And they did one about Derrida. And in that, they're trying to get the nonsense and the opaqueness that is Derrida and make it understandable, like a sixth former. I know, I was one of those sixth formers reading it, and I couldn't understand what he was talking about, even from that. Yeah. And they portrayed, in that incident, the traditional dons of Cambridge as sort of Grecian columns. As if they were just conformist, they were just unthinking, they were just blocks of stone, saying things like, this is Dadaism, this isn't philosophy, you know, this is just trick. And the bias in favour of Derrida was quite incredible. And again, that press and things like it is now completely in thrall. Let's move on to that, though. I mean, I was going to... It naturally moves us on to it. The Populist Delusion, which is one of your two recent books. Mm-hmm. And there is this idea, I mean, what we were talking about earlier, about the idea that the left never quite understand they're in power. And I suppose that they don't, because the kind of people that are left-wing now, I think, they're individualistic. They're concerned with their own power, not the power of the group of which they are a part. Mm. And this means that it makes sense. Silent studio there, lots of padding. Mm. And this means it makes sense. If you're to be a successful individualist, as an individualist, you must get your own power within the society. You must never feel that you have power. Because then you rest on your laurels. You must always be striving for more. So you must always feel that you must, in a way, be neurotic, and it does correlate being an individual with being neurotic, with being high in anxiety. Therefore, you must always want more power. Whereas the people that are conservative, they are in favour of the good of their group. They are low in anxiety. They just want to grill. You know, they feel they have power, because it's psychologically healthy to feel that you're empowered. And so conservatives, I think, they feel, I'm doing okay. You know, it's this different way of thinking. The left are neurotic, so they're always going to strive, always going to see others as be paranoid. And that if you're paranoid, you want more. I wonder if that's relevant.
In my experience, one of the differences when it comes to something like teaching is that the typical conservative or right winger will actually cling on to some sort of ideal of neutrality, i.e., my political views are not going to be imposed through my teaching. I'm going to just teach you the material. You can make up your own mind, okay? Mm. But in my experience, that's an ideal that only really people on our side of things have. And that left wing is actually, they're much more instrumental in terms of, no, I'm basically going to brainwash you. You know, I'm going to use my class in order to make you a miniature version of me. Mm-hmm. Feminist, a Marxist, whatever. So it almost becomes like a kind of factory line, which, you know, to one way of thinking would be, you know, well, that's an abuse of your position. Well, that's an abuse of your power. But they don't see it that. They don't really see it that way. I'm not even sure if they're aware of it.
I think they, as far as they're concerned, what the neurotic personality means that you develop this idea that you are morally better than others. You are perfect. You know best. And you really do know best. And it follows that you must spread the word. Mm-hmm. You know best. Whereas a person that has I mean, you could say that this narcissism is a product of low self-esteem. A person that has normal self-esteem is higher in agreeableness, basically. Higher in out, will not think they know best. They'll think, well, I know some things, I don't know other things. They will have a kind of humility, which perhaps conservatives have, which the left don't. And therefore, they will say, well, I'll just tell you my, I will do my best to honestly, you know, do this. You don't have the fervour. Before I continue with the red pills, I must quickly remind you of a white pill. Whatever disasters we are going to witness, the world will keep spinning because the conservative and the religious are having more children than the progressives, meaning that eventually all spiteful mutants will be bred out of the gene pool and society will function once again like it used to. You've obviously heard this argument before from me, and I've developed it in my book, The Past is a Future Country, The Coming Conservative Revolution, with my co-author, Joe A. Rayner Hills. You should definitely read that book, but if you haven't got the time to read it, I can offer you a shortcut. There is, in fact, a very good summary of our core arguments available, which you can listen to in just under 20 minutes on Learjent.com. Learjent is a new app where you can read and listen to short summaries of all the key arguments of many based books. These are all under 25 minutes long, so you can finish the whole book while you're out and about, in the gym, or on your way to work. Now, you might have heard of some competitors with a similar offer, but the big difference is that you will never find my books or books as the bell curve on these platforms. Learjent, on the other hand, is a platform run by based people who specifically want you to know about my research and those of others like me. So go on to Learjent.com now and sign up my promo code TJH for a 10% discount. But what I was wanting to move on to, I suppose, being to that, is this idea that we have that they promote all the time in the media, that the way it's the power of the people. The people brought us the NHS. Mm-hmm. The people brought us the vote. The people, and you've argued in your book that this is rubbish.
Yes, I mean, the best analogy I can make is to an army, okay? No army functions in a bottom-up manner. You know, there's a command structure with a general at the top and then various different classes of officers and then the privates down at the bottom who just take, their job is to take orders and not, and, you know, carry them out. They do not make the decisions, the massa in the kind of command unit or whatever. And so it is with the army. So it is with basically all of society. And this I have found is one of the ideas that a lot of people struggle with, because we have been taught our whole lives to believe that the system is responsive to the opinions of the people. And that all of the major changes that were brought about were bottom-up, organic kind of movements, whereas in fact, almost every single one of them have been elite projects. From 60s counterculture, for example, very much an elite project. I mean, I remember a Peter Hitchens interview once where he said the 60s basically happened in 1 square mile of London and 1 square mile of San Francisco. But what we think of as being the 60s as this kind of explosion of youth energy.
When you say an elite project, though, would it be fairer to say that it was a discontented subgroup within the elite, as opposed to an elite? I mean, why on earth would the actual elite that are running the country want to cause all the chaos that was wrought by this sort of stuff?
I actually think it was, and the 60s was backed. In fact, there's evidence that the CIA, for example, were fully cognizant of what was going on and, in fact, wanted to present an image of America as the nation of freedom as against the dour Soviet bloc. So it was actually part of a conscious project to project America as this kind of voice of freedom in the world, okay? So they were pretty happy with the Beatles and the Stones and so on being at the forefront of that. But to give you an example of how this was elite-driven as opposed to kind of people-driven, I mentioned Peter Hitchens. He, as an example, given that you've mentioned the Rolling Stones several times, there was a famous case where they were facing possible jail time for taking drugs of various different kinds in the mid-60s. And there was a poll of youth in the mid-60s, i.e. what should happen to Mick Jagger? You know, should he go to jail? Should he... And the youth of that time said that he should actually face harsher treatment than he is, that like they should throw the book at him, that this was a kind of, you know, so in other words, the youth of that period were actually pretty conservative in their outlook. But the liberal establishment of that period, including several Tory MPs and Tory kind of backers like William Rees-Mogg, they wanted to show that they were right on and hip and trendy, and but they backed the Rolling Stones in that. And history has since remembered the 60s in a very different way. I mean, this is only one example of many examples we could pull on. It is almost always an organized minority as against the disorganized mass. And the organized minority, if they're organized enough and if they control enough mechanisms of influence and power, can actually then dictate the way certain things are remembered later on. I mean, Martin Luther King would be another very good example. You know, all anybody knows of Martin Luther King today, you know, especially conservatives who love to quote we want to judge people on the content of the character, not by the color of their skin. You know, it's endlessly quoted. What is less remembered is, you know, the backing that Martin Luther King had, the sort of funding he had, the sort of
from a communist,
the sort of violent actions he was involved with, the agitation he was part of. I mean, he was basically, you know, similar to the BLM of its day. You know, all of those things are not remembered. Instead, we're encouraged to think of him as a kind of icon and a kind of a voice of his generation, whereas in fact, he was not backed by the majority of Americans at the time.
No, the same is true of Nelson Mandela. The same is true of Emmeline Pankhurst. I was talking with Simon Webb about this earlier. She was against the votes for working class women, absolutely actively against it. Mm-hmm. And the same is true of so many of these others, that they are remembered in the way that what is desired to. I suppose it's basic psychology that a small minority. But can you explain? I'll let you say it. Mm-hmm. Why is it that a small minority is more like that, is more powerful and able to do more than a majority that is?
Well, I mean, I'll go back to the military analogy. You can imagine 100 organized men against 1,000 men who are disorganized. They will win 10 times out of 10 if they know what they're doing. You know, this is why in many battles it was always a priority to take the officers out, because once you get rid of the officers, the other guys don't, you know, they can't move in a coordinated way.
The Japanese in the war, in their prisons or their concentration camps, whatever you want to call them, would first of all, they get rid of the officers, mm-hmm. and then they would identify whom, from their behaviour, whom among the men were what they called the king rats.
Right.
That's the term they used. Yeah. And then they would just put the king rats in separate cells.
Mm-hmm.
And then once there was no one, there were no natural leaders, then the men were just obedient.
Right. And so it's basically this principle, but on a societal wide scale. In fact, a very interesting person to read on this is Edward Bernays, you know, the father of modern propaganda and public relations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's famous for being the man who got women to smoke cigarettes, okay? But one of the things that he talks about is, you know, when you're presented with poll data and the public does not want what you're selling, whether it's a cigarette or whether it's a political ideal or a policy or whatever else, his response to that isn't to say, oh, okay, then. It is to say, well, no, we can change the public's mind. And not only can we change the public mind, we can do it in such a way that the person thinks that they have come up with the idea themselves. This is the kind of the genius of really subtle propaganda. You actually think that you're coming up with it.
You think, like those girls at Oxford University I mentioned earlier, that you've come up, a debate has been had. You think it's been talked about, and you've come to your conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
But you haven't at all.
And what Bernays would do, he would actively target the authority figures. Who do people really respect in society? Well, you know, and we're so familiar with many of the tropes that he introduced now, but I don't know, you're flogging detergent or something, put a man in a white coat, you know, present science data. Oh, you know, our scientists have said that this detergent brand is the cleanest one on the market. You know, trust me, I'm a doctor type thing. And, you know, people gravitate towards authority and trust. Or, I don't know, the celebrity endorsement would be another one. Well, you like this person, you can transfer some of that to somebody else. So these are all kind of persuasion tactics that have routinely been used by the people in power since at least the 1920s, 1930s.
Yeah. So how can you, according to your model of the elite theory, can you run us through, I mean, the most dramatic thing in my lifetime, and it makes me angry thinking about it, mm-hmm. makes me so angry thinking about it, is 1st of May 1997. And of course, the less intelligent way of thinking about that would be to say, okay, Labour were elected on the 1st of May 1997, and then... Although they gradually they took power and they passed all of these anti-democratic laws and whatever they did, but of course it's not so. You've got to go back a lot further to look at this tiny minority and what they did.
Yes,
you run through kind of what they, how did we've now living with it. I mean, it's what we can't. Mm-hmm. They've taken over all the judges, the journalists, the every television, every schools, every organ.
You're talking about Tony Blair.
Tony Blair is a genius. I mean, he's a genius.
Yes. I mean, they were very good at this sort of thing. They were very good at their kind of basic persuasion stuff that we're talking about just now. But, I mean, I seem to remember at the time, one of the things Blair did is he made the decision-making circle very small, very non-democratic, if you think about it. Do you remember the period of sofa politics? What that meant was is that most of the cabinet were not in on key decisions that had to be made. And they were very good at what I discussed earlier, which is acting, just doing something, and then having everybody else react to it after they'd brought it in. And they had a majority large enough where they could actually do that at that time. So... I mean, there's any number. You look at any of the acts, how small the amount of time they actually debated it, how small the attention of anybody in the media was at that time. And partly that was achieved by actually controlling the mechanisms of who was in which positions in which institutions. And then what the Blairites did, which was, again, genius, as you put it, is they set up many new institutions and peopled them with loyalists to their ideology. One example of that is Ofcom, which was established in 2003 by the Communications Act, and peopled with, you know, stuffed full of Blairites, essentially. And then when the Tories came in, they could have abolished Ofcom overnight, but they didn't. They've let it stay there. And in fact... The Tory party itself is now basically peopled by Blairites, you know.
I find it amazing that the Conservative Party wouldn't come in 2010, or when they got a majority, 2015, and just, 2019, a bigger majority, and just reverse everything Labour had ever done. Everything, one act. They should just undo every single law. That would be what they should do.
They didn't do that.
But no way, never.
And one of the reasons for that is that post-war Conservatives of the kind of... Thatcher, Reagan type variety, I guess, or from that kind of settlement that was made, you know, after the 70s, they tend to think a lot more about process, rules and process and precedent. But this, I mean, it strikes me as a completely theoretical world that nobody cares about. So, I mean, I remember reading a book by Thomas Sowell, you know, great economist, well-respected and so on, called Knowledge and Decisions, where he says in there, what really matters are the incentives and constraints in front of you in an institution. It doesn't matter who is there. What matters is the incentives and constraints in front of them and the procedures and the feedback loops. This is his way. He's thinking about it like an economist, as if it's a kind of fair game. I would just say it absolutely does matter who is in which post, because if it's a left winger, they will use and abuse every little bit of power they have to turn it into, you know, a little node of power in the system for themselves. And that I would say that difference between the focus on actual personnel and rules, process, and procedures, I would say, is probably one of the big hidden reasons why the left have won so often, because they actually do care who it is. In fact, you can actually see it now in the Labour Party now, where Keir Starmer is literally just purging every single Corbynista. It doesn't really matter if the Corbynista says, well, I've changed my mind or I've got a new set of values now. They want to replace every single actual individual person with someone who's going to be loyal to their new project.
Yeah, that's the thing they should do. Although, to be fair, he was a Corbynista himself, and he was part of Corbyn's...
Right, I mean, he was kind of in disguise, I guess, a Blairite in disguise as a Corbynista. But you understand what I'm saying, right? And it just tends to be that Conservatives don't think like this. They lack that kind of ruthlessness. They tend to think, well, you know, if you're qualified for the job and whatnot, you can... You know, what they really should be thinking is either... All of these are kind of castles set up by Tony Blair. We need to destroy each and every single one of those. Or we need to replace root and branch, fire all of the people who were there and replace them with people who are going to be friends of ours. But of course, they don't do that. And I think that one of the reasons they don't do it, without going on too much of a tangent, is because they're on the same side, basically. They're just the same. There's no difference.
Well, I suppose the difference is that the centrist conservative, the whatever you want to call it, the purple-pilled conservative, whatever, is a the conservatism is shifting. These people are now nostalgic. It's the conservatism of nostalgia rather than an ideological conservatism where so there are certain principles. And it's just the idea that, oh, it was better 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. That's it. It was better 10 years ago. Let's go back then. Let's go, oh, remember 20 years ago? Remember 20 years ago when men were men and women were women? Just go back to that. But that was the they'll be perfectly happy with the idea of, I don't know, women in the army. Mm-hmm. That was brought in a bit longer ago. We'll have that. So it's this nostalgia. It's the conservative that is basically just as a left wing person, but some decades.
I'm not even sure if they're a left wing person. I reckon many of the current crop of Tory MPs are probably like on the forefront of trendy left wing. I think some of them are even woker than the...
Well, possibly. I suppose with some of them, if you are fundamentally power hungry, and you're noticing you're going into politics round about 2005, let's say that's when you're starting to apply to be, you think, oh, I'll go into politics. Someone like Liz Truss, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Then you are the time's up for Labour. Mm-hmm. The time's up. They've been in for over 10 years, or whatever, a bit less than 10 years. It's time's up. The future is clearly with the Conservative Party of David Cameron. That's where it is. So if you're going to go into politics and you want power, that's probably what you should do rather than Labour and or Lib Dems, obviously. And so you can see that there's going to be a certain kind of basically left-wing person, really, individualist.
Well, I mean,
that point.
On top of that, of course, one of the things that most people should know but don't is that David Cameron, of course, had all woman shortlists. He had all... minority shortlists, and basically did his own version of kind of affirmative action diversity in the 2010 crop.
He put pressure on them, I believe I'm right in saying, I once spoke to a quite senior politician about this. It was the pressure was that a final three are put to the local Conservative Association to vote on who should be their prospective parliamentary candidate, and that they said that one of those should be a woman. And that was the system. And so even though the woman that goes there, she might be the 10th best of those they've interviewed, she must go into the final three. And with ethnic minorities, they were strongly, strongly encouraged and given a leg up and helped out. And informal pressure was put on the associations. So someone like Swella Braverman.
The entire current crop come from this Cameron, you know, subtle affirmative action, you know. And then they have the audacity to have a go. Like, you know, they almost treat it like winning the World Cup. You know, we've had three female prime ministers and the first non-white prime minister. You know, it's almost like, you know, winning a football match to them. That's how the Tories now kind of...
That's how they promote it, yeah. And it's speaking of non-white, I want to move on to, well, not non-white, but you personally, your background, how you moved into this. So tell you, so how did a half Iranian, half Welsh in the northern, how did your life start off?
Well, I grew up in Wales.
How did your Iranian father end up in Wales?
He was actually studying engineering in Cardiff in the 70s. Shah was in power at that time, and in fact he was on some sort of scholarship, you know, from the Shah. I mean, if you know anything about the history of Iran, the Anglo-Iranian or the Anglo-Persian Oil Company was instrumental in discovering oil and, you know, kind of establishing the Iranian oil industry. So there was pretty big links, I would say, between Britain and Iran up until 1979. There was the small matter of the Mossadegh coup, which we don't need to get into here. But anyway, that is why my dad was in Wales at that time. And, you know, I'm not exactly sure how my parents met, but let's just say they were at a disco or whatever and met my mother and ended up getting married. And at that time, you know, she was from the valleys.
And she's from the south.
She was from the South Wales, from the valleys. And at that time, when my dad went down there, he was the first, quote-unquote, non-white person that many of those people had ever seen, like ever. So, you know, that was quite a thing for my mother to do at that time. I think that,
Did her parents disapprove?
Well, her father died when she was younger. I think my dad, when he turned up, must have seemed impossibly exotic to her, I think. He represented an escape. I mean, you know, valleys, how can I say, you know, they didn't have a lot of money and it was a coal mining town. And, you know, he represented a kind of adventure and you know, he was from the, like, people didn't travel as much back in those days. And, you know, he worked on a ship and they went around the world. And in fact, my parents had pretty interesting lives, I would say. They've kind of been everywhere. So when I was growing up, often on the TV, we'd be seeing like, a, you know, let's say it was Argentina. My mother would say, oh, you've been there. Or, you know, Egypt, or you've been there. It all happened, you know.
Well, he was an engineer on ships.
He was, he was an engineer, a marine engineer, they called it. A chief engineer, if you want. So think of Scotty from Star Trek or whatever, but the equivalent of that on a ship, if you can imagine.
Right.
You can imagine that ship just travelled around the world, port to port to port to port. And sometimes the wives would go with them for various legs of the tour. And also I did when I was a baby. And that's very much what my dad is like. He's kind of an adventurous spirit, if you want. Mm-hmm. Anyway, when the revolution happened in Iran, my mother can speak a bit of Farsi. She's been over there, you know, met my grandparents and gets on well with.
You've been over there, met them.
I've only been over there twice in my adult life, and once when I was very little. So I've had very little time in Iran. But she, you can speak a bit of Farsi. But she says that when the revolution happened, people turned overnight. You know, she's got blonde hair and people went from being like her best friend to like almost spitting at her in the street. That was the kind of strength of feeling when the revolution happened. So obviously she was never going to go. And because I think their original plan would be to live over there because they would have had a much better lifestyle. But obviously when that happened, they were like, well, that's not going to happen. So that's when they decided they were going to live in Wales. Mm-hmm. I was around.
Is it North Wales?
No, South Wales. South Wales. I grew up in a little town in South Wales. And in fact, we moved there because there was a good school there. And that's the school private school that I went to. Apart from that, the extent to which I am Iranian is very...
Were you Muslim? Were you?
Oh, no. Because my dad's not religious at all. And the extent to which, the Iranian part, it's kind of something I almost never thought about when I was growing up. You kind of weren't encouraged to... I don't know if you really talked about that sort of stuff.
But why did they give you... I mean, you've got the surname is Parvini, fine, it's your dad's name. Why did they give you an Iranian Christian name? They wanted to give you
It's actually an ancient Persian name. My grandfather, they agreed that if they had daughters, they would have an English name. And if they had sons, it would be a Persian name. And it was like my grandfather that came up with both my name and my brother's name. So, yeah, I have him to thank for my rather unusual name. So,
your dad's dad.
Yeah.
And you've met him.
Yeah, I mean, all my grandparents are dead now. But, he was an interesting fellow in his own right, but we don't need to go into that. He would kind of like just start reciting verses. He wrote books and things. He was kind of people would always say to me that I took after him because he was very intellectual as well. So, he could write, and he was kind of quite a well-respected guy, you know, within his community. My dad actually came from the people called the Bakhtiari people, who were still kind of tribal. And I remember when my grandfather died, over 300 people went to his funeral from that tribe because that's how well-respected he was. So, yeah, I mean, it was kind of... But in terms of my own kind of childhood and upbringing and so on, all of that stuff didn't really come into it much. We didn't have any other Iranian families around, or, you know, there was kind of one family that lived in Woking who were kind of somehow related to my father, like second cousins or whatever. So occasionally we'd go and see them. And
the oldest mosque in England, Woking.
They had a few more. There were a few more families around there. And I remember going to a few things where there was like, oh, we're going to some Iranian festival, or we're going to do this. And I was never that comfortable with it. I always thought it was kind of a little bit fake in a way for me to just suddenly try to start wearing this as a badge. You know, I like back in my, you know, talking about cynical Gen X Daria,
yeah.
I always thought that the kids who really tried to take on their parents' culture were always doing it in a kind of strange badge-wearing way, because it was something else that made them stand out.
Were there other kids at your private school that were half foreign or whatever?
Not really that I can remember. There was a couple. In fact, there was a couple in that school. But then later, there were a few.
But did they do this badge wearing, as you said?
Well, I mean, years later, my first wife was from a Bengali background. Like both of her parents were, and through that, I got to see quite a bit of their kind of, various festivals and so on. And she didn't do that, but through her, like various cousins of hers, you know, somebody born and brought up in Richmond, say, pretending they've got an Indian accent.
Ah, to that extent.
You're right, like literally going to the extent where they were actually now affecting. And I just thought, like, something odd is going on here. I was never comfortable with that kind of, I guess you'd call it these days, identity politics, wouldn't you? But I don't know. That was something I never really went for.
So you just took the Welsh.
Because that is what I was born, brought up into. It's all I'd ever known, and, you know,
didn't your father insist on eating funny food, lamb's heads and things?
We had some Persian food, and my parents spoke a bit of Farsi in the house and so on. But to the extent to which it kind of, I mean, unless you're going to live in a culture, you can't really embody it, if that makes any sense. So in a strange way, I always felt it was a bit tokenistic. I've always been keen on authenticity. And I don't know, it felt somehow not inauthentic.
Did you ever experience any of, like, you know, like racism or racist comments or anything like that?
Not really. There was one incident where somebody called my dad Saddam Hussein, and I got into a fight with that.
Yeah, Iraqis and Iranians hate each other.
Right. But the reason I got so angry is that my dad was almost killed in the Iran-Iraq war. They bombed his ship, and he lost his, you know, lost his wedding ring and got melted.
His finger?
No, he didn't lose his finger, but like the ship where his he had his wedding ring and put it on the side.
Oh,
that went down, like, you know, somehow he survived or whatever. But so, you know, I did like I didn't take kindly to that because of course they'd just been at war and Saddam Hussein almost killed my dad, so I wasn't happy about that. But that's pretty much the only thing I can remember. It's ever kind
there
of...
There couldn't have been... I remember you saying to me when we last met that in the part of Wales where you're from, black people are referred to as TV people.
I mean, I don't know. I don't know if that's a kind of common expression, but yeah, you didn't actually see... When I was growing up, you didn't see that many so-called, you know, non-white people anywhere, really. There was, a couple of kids in my school... you know, my dad, if you count him, but, you know, not really. But you see, the thing is that you weren't encouraged to think about these things in the 80s and 90s. And I call this Back to Fresh Prince. Yeah. And you were encouraged to think of everybody just as an individual. You weren't encouraged to think about things like your kind of collective group identity. So, you know, I, like everybody else, just kind of grew up in that mindset. And it's only much later that you come to realize that this mindset in itself is, as Jonathan Haidt put it, weird, right? It's kind of like most people in the world don't think like this. And in fact, nobody in Britain thought like this.
Well, I think I was personally, my school in South London, you're kind of confronted with it because there was a lot of Asian kids. And I was once, not so many black children at all, but a lot of Asians. And I was once, I think it was about, I was about maybe 8 or 9 years old. And I was once at a birthday party and there was 8 kids, including me. And the other 7 were Pakistani Muslims and me. And so, you know, if you're best friends, then you start thinking about it. And I remember seeing a photograph of, I don't know, it was from Winchester in about 1900, something like that. I was about 7 or 8. And I said, and of course, they were all white. And I innocently said to my grandfather, "Well, where are all the Asian people?" He said, "There weren't no bloody Asian people in Winchester there, or even bloody Asians. They came up with the bloody 50s. Yeah. And I, really? Yeah. And it never occurred to me. It's some weird way that when you don't think coherently when you're a child. So on the one hand, you have this thinking that, yeah, England is... white countries, white people, everyone else is under sufferance. But on the other hand, it never occurred to me that it wasn't a very ancient thing somehow. It hadn't crossed my mind.
Yeah, I mean, one of the points I've made time and again is that, you see, with my dad, for example, he was just one man in a town alone. And that, like I said, there were no other Iranian families around. Now, I've often thought that my life and also his life may have been extremely different if there had just been one more family down the street, or two more families down the street, because now you're not an individual, you're a group, you're a phalanx, you're a, you know, there's a natural kind of propensity, I think, to band together if you see somebody who's like yourself.
Are you ready for the future of the West?